Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Too Much Information is a production of iHeart Radio.
And welcome to another episode of Too Much Information, the show that brings you the secret facts and little known history behind your favorite movies, music, TV shows, and more. We are your heinous bitches of hagiography, your updated Shakespeare sagas of up-to-date details, your list-loving Lotharios of all things pop culture. There are some who say we're just too good to be true. My name is Jordan Runtug.
That was a good one. I was with you the whole way.
Thank you.
And I'm Alex Heigl.
And today we are talking about one of the crown jewels of the late 90s string of stellar teen comedies, 10 Things I Hate About You. This modern update of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew, a name that did not age well, charmed audiences and critics alike when it was released at the end of March 1999, 25 years ago. It made stars out of Julia Stiles and Heath Ledger and birthed some iconic cinematic moments that live in the hearts of millennials and any discerning cineast, really, forever. Although I generally preferred my teen movies to be more of the early 60s Frankie and Annette variety, I did catch the batch that came out during this era. Can't Hardly Wait, American Pie, Clueless, She's All That, my personal favorite, and of course this one. We were spoiled with these when we were growing up. Great run there. While you and I were slightly younger than the characters in these movies, for me, they were almost aspirational in a sense. They offered an idea of what was on the horizon when I graduated middle school and made it to the big leagues of high school, where I remained as weird and dorky as ever. Heigl, what do you think of 10 Things I Hate About You?
You know, my memories of this said teen boob are mostly of me trying to see boobs in movies. So anything that wasn't like a hard R was kind of an out for me.
That surprises me. I could see you being into the hijinks of this movie.
Oh my gosh, no.
Really?
No.
Is it too sweet?
Yes. If I wanted hijinks at this time, I would have gone to Jackie Chan.
Or do them yourself.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, Jackass was going around at this point.
Okay. Oh, that is true. That is true.
Yeah, I don't know. I love sweet baby Heath Ledger in this. He's just adorable. But I've never really been the world's biggest Julia Stiles fan. And I think I was just like residual crushing on Larissa Olenek from The Secret World of Alex Mack. And
oh, of course. Yeah.
It doesn't really go any further than that for me.
I mean, to be fair to everybody listening right now, I sprung this on Heigl like maybe 3 hours ago that we were doing this. Oh yeah, I had a change of plan over the weekend. I read 10 Things I Hate About You instead of, I believe Frank Sinatra's My Way was what we were going to do.
Yeah, it's quite the about face.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. So you were handling this like a champ, I have to say.
I mean, it's like pretty much anything I say about this time period is that like given the current state of Hollywood and in particular like the low mid-budget comedy, like if you just go back to this era and you're like, wow, this was shot on film with like real sets and real wardrobe and it's not a grayed out mess.
And real people.
With no blocking and like nothing that used to make things a movie. And you're just like, wow, okay. I forgot there used to be craft in this. It just wasn't an assembly line feeding slop into a streaming outlet trough.
And that's the weird thing, too, because, I mean, not to sound like I'm big upping myself or like an old man yelling at a cloud. In the 90s, when these movies were being made, I was really into watching stuff from the 50s and 60s. And I remember thinking in the 90s, wow, this is crap compared to like what I like to watch from back then. So now it's doubly humbling to revisit these things from my childhood now and be like, oh, they're better than I remember.
Just as an aside, were the 50s still like an era when they were getting like Faulkner to write this stuff or like Graham Greene? Okay, so there were like... You know, it was being written by like famous novelists.
Yeah, like F. Scott Fitzgerald moved to Hollywood before he died. Yeah. I mean,
well, yeah, great.
Well, a quick reminder for those who haven't seen 10 Things I Hate About You in a while, much like American Pie and She's All That, the plot centers around a wager. A wager, a deal. A deal. We're going to make a little deal. An agreement. I guess American Pie wasn't really a bet. It was more of an agreement.
Sort of a gentleman's handshake. a gentleman's handshake situation.
The story of 10 Things I Hate About You follows two sisters, Bianca and her elder sister, Kat. Bianca, who's played by Larissa Olenek, our beloved Alex Mack from Nickelodeon fame, wants to begin dating, but her father will not allow it until Kat starts dating as well. So Bianca's suitor, a John Hughes baddie-esque type, named, I think his character is Joey Donner, pays the school loner, played by Heath Ledger, to try to woo the ill-tempered antisocial Kat, played by Julia Stiles, thus clearing the way for him to start dating Bianca. And hilarity ensues, I guess. Going over this now, this plot is Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. I don't think I realized until researching this episode that part of the reason that so many of these late 90s teen movies hold up is because their plots are revamps of classics and are extremely durable. Clueless is Jane Austen's Emma. She's All That is Pygmalion or My Fair Lady. Take your pick. I'm sure there are others.
The 12th Night one isn't that Amanda Bynes?
Oh, She's the Man. Yeah. So I guess it makes sense that these movies are holding up as well as they did, because not only have they held up for 25 years, they've held up for centuries. Well, from the alternate leads we nearly saw instead of Heath Ledger and the songs he nearly sang instead of Frankie Valli, to the complex torrent of emotions behind Julia Stiles' tears as she recited the titular poem, here's everything you didn't know about 10 Things I Hate About You. Ten Things I Hate About You came from the minds of first-time writers Kristen Smith and Karen McCullough. They would go on to become teen movie writing royalty, writing classic female-driven rom-coms like Legally Blonde, Ella Enchanted, the aforementioned She's the Man, and The House Bunny. Hell of a run there, wow. But it all started with 10 Things. Desperate to break into the industry, they were inspired by the success of 1995's Clueless, in which Amy Heckerling took the plot of Jane Austen's Emma and set it in a 1990s high school. I have to be honest, I had no idea that Clueless was an adaptation of Jane Austen. Yeah. Did you?
I mean, I think it was pointed out to me at the time, but I certainly hadn't read Emma at that point.
Yeah.
Or ever. Respectfully.
Did you ever have those great illustrated classics books as a kid?
Yep.
I always assumed that that was like the real version of the book. And then years later, yeah.
I've read Emma.
Yeah. And then I realized I got to high school and I was like, oh, what are these words? Oh, damn it. And I was really upset. I was so proud of myself. It was a real point of pride that I just crushed all these books. It should have been a tip off. They were all 238 pages. That all great works of literature weren't mysteriously the same page count, but it didn't dawn on me.
Yeah.
Anyway, Karen McCullough explained in a 2015 interview with The Script Lab, "We knew we wanted to write a teen movie, and when Clueless came out, we thought Amy Heckerling was a genius for contemporizing a classic, so we decided to try that as well." Their thoughts turned to Shakespeare because it worked for West Side Story and The Lion King a few years earlier, and Kiss Me, Kate, and I don't know, the Baz Luhrmann version of Romeo and Juliet was probably big around that time, too, in the mid-90s. So, I don't know. Shakespeare. Cigar-chopping executive. Shakespeare. I heard good things.
So hot right now.
So they opted for The Taming of the Shrew. and they would return to the Shakespeare well for She's the Man, which we mentioned earlier, which was a revamp of Twelfth Night. McCullough continued to the script lab. We chose Taming of the Shrew and figured out which storylines we wanted to keep an update and how we'd go about it. And then we outlined all the characters and the story while we sat on a beach in Mexico.
Yeah.
Not a bad place for first-time writers to bang out an outline, let me tell you. Nods to Shakespeare and his works are sprinkled throughout the final version of 10 Things I Hate About You. We'll touch on more of that later. For instance, there's the character Mandela, who's obsessed with the playwright and ultimately receives a Shakespeare-inspired promposal in the film. Which is funny, because I thought the promposals were like a social media phenomenon. Yeah. I didn't know that they would go that far back.
Yeah. God. Prom. I think my girlfriend at the time just like looked at each other and were like, fine. That's my promposal.
I was too shy to ask the person I wanted to ask, so I asked her sister instead in some weird Gatsby-esque attempt to make her jealous. I don't know why I did that. I was friends with her sister, I should say. In fact, but so it was a friend date, but yeah.
This episode's going to drag up a lot of feelings, huh?
I was going to say, yeah, all the high school stuff. I wasn't thinking about it. Yeah, somebody in the comments said they don't like when we go off into our sad personal anecdotes. But you know what? This ain't your night, baby. getting back to Shakespeare, in 10 Things I Hate About You, there are character names and location names and even a few direct quotes thrown in to nod to his work. So the plot of 10 Things I Hate About You is inspired by the Bard, but the title comes from real life.
Stripped from the headlines.
Yes. Or the diary, more like. Once the pair of writers decided they were going to tackle a script set in high school, Karen McCullough decided to read through her high school diaries for an authentic blast of teen angst. And that's when she stumbled on an angry entry she'd written about her then-boyfriend, Anthony. She shared this with her collaborator, Kristen Smith, who immediately said, "That's our title." The name of this entry was 10 Things I Hate About Anthony. And the working title for the script was actually 10 Things I Hate About Andy, a slight name change to protect the guilty, until they ultimately tweaked it to the second person.
How hard do you think they kicked themselves when they got a percentage of the way through shooting without realizing that they were one word off of like a naming, like a riff on 10 Things I Hate About You? Like the Taming of the Shrew, 10 Things I Hate About You, having like the same rhythm and scansion. Like, do you think it was like a big light bulb moment for everyone in one room, or someone just quietly noticed and was like, I'm going to make this call?
I didn't notice that until you just said it right now.
Really?
Never.
I was completely deliberate from
10
the ground
things
up.
I hate about you.
10 Things I Hate About You, The Taming of the Shrew.
It's kind of forced, but it's not bad.
What isn't in Hollywood?
Tweeted us about, is this title?
They forced Julia Stiles on us.
Oh, what do you like about her?
She's wooden.
Really?
Just not a good actress?
Really?
Maybe it's just Save the Last Dance. Because like even as a child, I looked at that and was like, this is problematic. With like a preternatural understanding of what that word meant.
Well, on a happier note, Karen McCullough remained friends with her ex, Anthony. And he was apparently very flattered that he helped inspire cinematic greatness. In fact, he would often ring up Karen McCullough to confirm the story to doubting friends and relatives. McCullough said, I'll get a random phone call in the middle of the night. Hey, my nephew doesn't believe the title is about me. Tell him. And so I'm on the phone like, yes, I hated Anthony in high school. And probably right now, he's calling me at all hours.
McCullough and Smith wrote the script on spec, which means they had to shop it. And it ultimately wound up in the hands of an exec at Touchstone. And within months, or nanoseconds in Hollywood time, it was greenlit. Which is great for them. Wonderful for... God, what a better time to be working and alive as a professional. For director, Touchstone turned to Gil Junger, or Junger.
Yeah, and he's quite a character in this. I think you're going to like him, or at least like talking about him. He's a...
Did people say, get me the Junger?
Going for the jungular?
Ooh, good one. He takes his glasses off. He's like, looks like it's time to go to the jungular.
Explosion in the background.
Yeah.
Yeah!
He was a newbie feature director, and at that point, he had only done episodes of TV shows like Ellen, Blossom, and Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place. So, big things. Even so, though, he wasn't eager to make his jump to the big screen with a teen version of The Taming of the Shrew, regardless of whether or not it rhymed. According to the film's production notes, his initial response was, "Absolutely not." He continued, "I had no interest in doing a typical high school film. I wanted to do a romantic love story. But at the urging of my agent, I read the script. I loved it. The depth of it surprised me. It really is a romantic love story. The plot is beautifully interwoven, and the humor works because it comes from the characters." Yeah, man, it's Shakespeare. glad you approved of it. These beats need work.
Yeah, this guy, get ready for this guy. You're going to have fun.
You know, it's good, but I think we can jung it up a little. He endeavored to make this film a cut above your standard issue cheapy teen rom-com. And some would say that he did. He elaborated to HuffPo in 2019. "When I got hired to do the movie, which was, of course, thrilling, I said, I'm not making a high school movie. I look at this as a relationship movie between two people that happen to be in high school because I want my 40-something friends to come to this movie and dig it. I refuse to make a high school film in a condescending manner of any kind. I just find the genre to be so derivative." Said the guy directing someone else's script that was an adaptation of The Taming of the Shrew. When it came time to cast the movie, director Gil Junger recalled being under immense pressure from Disney, Touchstone's parent company, to consider the teens from Dawson's Creek, which was extremely popular at the time. According to Gil's retelling, he had the chutzpah, the yungspa, if you will, to tell the studio heads, "Please just give me the chance to cast this myself. I'll screen test them, and you can either say yes or no." And to his, and the rest of Hollywood's shock, Disney agreed. Once again, this was a first-time director coming from the Jim Belushi sitcom.
And Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place.
Katie Holmes was indeed considered for the role of Katarina Cat Stratford, who is described uncharitably on Wikipedia as, quote, "the antisocial, shrewish elder Stratford sister." No one seems to know if she either didn't get the part or if she turned it down. Eliza Dushku of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, also a pretty brunette.
And a Boston native.
As was a young, pre-almost famous, in both the literal and metaphorical sense, Kate Hudson. Casting director apparently loved Kate's audition, but Hudson ultimately passed on the role. Reportedly, because her mother, Goldie Hawn, didn't think it was a good fit. Wasn't it The Thing? When Kurt Russell was like up between two movies, Goldie Hawn was like, "You should do The Thing." And made, or Big Trouble. I think it was Big Trouble.
I think it was Big Trouble. Yeah.
Yeah. Good for her.
Yeah.
But it all worked out for Julia Stiles because it did.
Because she was a good fit. She was a good fit. A lot of people, we'll talk about this in auditions, they all basically told her to like smile more and stuff. And so she felt a real connection, a real kinship to this character.
Talking to Entertainment Weekly in 2019, Stiles said she was desperate to play Kat. "It was so refreshing to see a teenage girl who was so feisty," she added. "I thought that the writers had a healthy dose of cynicism with their humor that you don't always find with teen romantic comedies." She'd cite Ally Sheedy in The Breakfast Club and Molly Ringwald in 16 Candles as the character's spiritual ancestors, as well as some Winona Ryder roles, presumably Heathers, not so much Mermaids or Bram Stoker's Dracula. Stiles felt a kinship with the character because she was more or less told that she looked like a mean lady at auditions. "I was an auditioning actor, and mostly I would go out for commercials, and they would tell me that I wasn't bubbly enough. They always thought I was angry, so to read a part like Kat, I was like, ah, this is perfect for me." Director Gil Junger also felt it was perfect for Julia Stiles, feeling as though he'd knocked a young run. Or a home jung? Feeling as though he'd knocked a home jung. I'm going to keep these coming fast and heavy.
Yeah. Jungian humor.
As he elaborated to HuffPo, "With the character of Kat, I just wanted to say to kids, it's okay not to change or adjust who you are to feel connected to everybody else. Basically, don't behave in a way to make other people like you. Behave in a way that's true to who you are. To be honest, I always thought of it as a female empowerment film. So when I met Julia, forget it. She was exactly who Kat was. Just the way she shook my hand, I was like, this isn't a girl. This is a young woman to take seriously." That's a weird thing to say. She was 17, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Miss Laney's character note, in the original version of the script, Kat's mother was supposed to be alive, but they decided to kill her off to give Kat a, quote, reason for her attitude. And presumably to whittle down the call list.
You're reading this like Bill Shatner. I like it.
Kat is seen reading the bell jar in the movie, a comically oversized prop version of the bell jar.
How did you like remember that?
Because I just remember seeing someone put a screen grab of it, like, love to grab my coffee table edition of the bell jar and relax in my oversized armchair. Julia Stiles was later connected to a film version of the bell jar.
That never got made.
Yeah. Wonderful.
I say this as, with all love. You don't feel a connection to somebody who's sick of people telling you, you seem so down and grumpy. Why don't you smile more? Life's beautiful. Life's good. Everything's good. Why don't you be happy? You don't feel a real sense of solidarity.
I am a better dancer.
I've never seen you dance, actually. Even when you, I guess when you were fronting our band, that wasn't really a dance. That was running to the back of the bar and grabbing a shot in the middle of a song and then coming back. Which was impressive.
I did do that.
It was cool.
Without missing a word.
You never did. Never did. Wow, you stuck me with all of the Heath Ledger stuff. Okay.
I thought you might want the gravitas.
In one of the DVD extra features, director Gil Younger described the challenges he faced while casting Patrick Verona, the main lead actor in the film.
Pat Verona sounds like a porn star name.
Pat Verona, or just the worst guy you went to high school with.
Fair.
Pat, I mean, yeah, Pat, maybe it's a New England thing, but yeah. Pat's run hot and cold, in my experience. Director Gil Younger described Patrick Verona as a complicated role. He needed to be masculine without trying to be masculine. He needed to be smart. He needed to be removed. He needed to be unbelievably charming, he said. They looked at hundreds of young actors, and early standouts were Ashton Kutcher, who then was enjoying a healthy Q score thanks to his role on That 70s Show, and also Josh Hartnett, who was in the midst of filming The Virgin Suicides at that time. And what else did he do? What was he?
Faculty.
Oh, yeah. Was he in a TV show?
Hartnett?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so, because like Halloween H2O and Faculty were some of his, like, I think H2O might have been his first movie.
I remember always hearing that name and seeing like posters of him on like friends' walls and stuff, but I really knew what he did.
Yeah, he's a sweet guy.
Okay, I'll take your word for it then.
He was expelled for writing a letter to the dean of the Conservatory of Theater Arts and Film at the State University of New York at Purchase.
Josh Hartnett?
Yes.
Cool.
He said the college's evaluation system stifled students' creativity, and they expelled him for it.
Wow.
Good for him. Must have been a hell of a letter. I'd love to read that.
Yeah.
An 18-year-old.
Is that on lettersofnote.com?
Oh, man.
Ooh.
I'd buy that on Heritage Auctions. Josh Hartnett's letter to the dean of SUNY.
And this concludes our It Belongs in Museum segment of the program.
Yeah, right. There we go. That and the prop version of the bell jar.
Yeah.
If we can find that.
I'm gonna find that in time for your birthday in November. But Ashton Kutcher and Josh Hartnett didn't have the raw magnetism that this budding autocratic director was looking for. And then in walked Heath Ledger. Director Gil Younger, yes, I will say his entire name and title throughout the remainder of this episode, would say that Heath, quote, just had a presence from the moment he walked in, and he was instantly sure that he would be a movie star. Normally, this would sound like retrospective horseshit, but I believe him in this case because it's yeah. Heath Ledger. Yeah, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Younger recalled thinking, if this dude can read, I'm going to cast him. He's just so unique looking.
Is that what he refers to as handsome? Like classically handsome?
Unique looking.
Strong jawline and beautiful hair. Like, he's so unique looking. He just looks like Adonis.
Younger added to viewmanity.com, Heath had never done a movie. He'd done the least amount of work of anyone on the cast, but he just exuded a sexuality and charisma that was palpable. It was thrilling in the initial reading. And the reading, it must be said, was very short. They gave him 8 pages to go through, and barely a minute into the first page, they stopped Heath and told him to put down the page. And poor Heath, he took this as a bad thing. He assumed he bombed the audition, and he looked terrified. And Gil Younger said, no, 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 this is a very good thing. I think you're a very talented guy, and I just want to improv with you for a while.
Oh my God, this guy sucks.
His quote continues, I wanted to see how facile his ability was to shift attitudes and maybe play off some humor. And we and we did that for about 45 seconds. And I said, okay, thank you so much for coming in. And he looked at me like, dude, I just flew here from Australia. You're spending 2 minutes with me for a 16-hour flight? Heigl, your thoughts?
Oh, no. Please read the next sentence.
Junger apparently placed a call to Heath's agent as soon as he was out of the room.
Continue.
Junger recalled saying to the women on the production team, ladies, I've never wanted to sleep with a man, but if I had to sleep with a man, that would be the man. Please call him immediately.
There it is.
Can we say that? I feel like you have to read that like Matthew Berry in The Things We Say in the Shadows.
Ladies,
yeah.
I've never wanted to sleep with a man, but if I had to sleep with a man, that would be the man.
Can we get him in front of a camera?
Please cast him immediately. He just exudes sexuality and charisma. Palpable.
That's very good.
Yeah,
very
this
good.
Guy fucking sucks, man. I always thought I was feeling bad for just like ragging on him earlier, but the fact that he like saw a bunch of like teens and was like, what a piece of ass.
He was 18.
He's okay, even still just being like, yeah, dude, man, you exude sexuality. You want to do improv together? do you like to hang around men's locker rooms? Like, what the fuck, man?
I knew you'd like this guy.
Oh, boy. I guess you could say he liked him Jung.
I'm going to regret reading what I wrote. Director Gil Junger's crush on Heath Ledger. I wrote adorable, but I'm rethinking that now. Is palpable, to use his own words. They tweaked the character bio for Patrick Verona to make him Australian so that Heath could keep his natural accent, which Junger felt made the character of Patrick, quote, dangerous and sexy. That I'm just hearing him with Matthew Berry now. Junger always remembered the outfit that Heath wore on the first day on the set. Cracked olive green leather pants, topped off with a white worn-out leather belt, some crazy pair of white shoes, a hat, and who knows what shirt. I looked at him and I thought to myself, if I put on any one of those pieces of clothing, everyone around me would burst out laughing. But for whatever reason, on Heath, it was so cool. He could sell anything. Sure, man.
Does it get better or worse?
Same.
Okay.
Same.
Continues. Yeah. It continues apace.
Yeah. Actually, no, it gets worse, but not just with Heath.
Oh, I bet he has thoughts on Larissa, doesn't he?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
This was famously Heath Ledger's first American movie, but he'd been a rising star in his native Australia for a few years. He was mostly known for roles in Australian TV series like Sweat, Ship to Shore, Roar, and Home and Away. Anyone? Anyone? Phil, friend of the pod, Phil, our resident favorite friend from Southern Hemisphere, Phil, please get in touch. Heath Ledger had appeared in the 1997 Australian feature film Black Rock, but that was pretty much the extent of his filmography. As a result, Touchstone got him cheap, reportedly shelling out just $100,000 for what would become Heath Ledger's breakout role. And he threw himself into it with his trademark gusto that would kind of kill him? Yeah, right? Yeah. In addition to improvising on set, it was his idea, for example, to grab at the flame in the scene in the science lab. He's literally playing with fire. Get it? He's like, you know? Yeah. He studied extensively for his part. He drew inspiration from Richard Burton's 1967 portrayal of Petruchio, the Taming of the Shrew character upon which his role of Patrick Verona is based. And he also strove to give, quote, a Jack Nicholson edge to him with his cheekiness and his smiles. And Heath would famously revisit his love of Jack Nicholson nearly a decade later when he portrayed the Joker, a role Jack had originated on the big screen in Tim Burton's 1989 adaptation of your beloved Batman. Another thing that Heath Ledger brought to the role, supposedly, sources say, is his car. The red 1963 Dodge Dart that Cat drives in the film was reportedly Heath's, at least if various listicles are to be believed. I had a hard time running that down. I couldn't get the VIN number.
Do you think they paid him to they paid it to ship it across the country?
Oh,
or
man.
He just bought it.
I didn't think of that.
The ocean, or he just bought it in LA?
It's a very LA car. It's a sick car.
If you or a loved one have a Dodge Dart that you'd like to sell us, we don't have the money.
Well, Venmo you $5.
Yeah.
In installments.
That is our budget.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more Too Much Information in just a moment.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, the sizzling on-screen chemistry between the pair, Heath Ledger and Julia Stiles, led fans to wonder if there was anything going on IRL, as the kids say, between the 19-year-old Heath and the 17-year-old Julia, my notes say.
Hey-o.
He's from Australia. You can't be extradited. Well, you're right to wonder, because apparently something was going on between the pair. Maybe Heath was just going method. I don't know. They played somewhat coy about this in interviews over the years, maybe because of the 17, 19-year-old thing. But during a 10th anniversary commentary, it was revealed that the two leads had started dating during filming, but drifted after the film's release. And by January 2000, they were done.
It'd be cool if you didn't mean drifted apart and you were like, they just got super into drifting. You know, they'd seen the Fast and the Furious movie. Became competitive drift racers together.
Heath had his Dodge Dart tricked out. And
yeah, exactly. If I get a time machine, that's what I'm going back and spending my time obsessively making sure that that goes right. Forget baby Hitler. I'll go back and make sure Heath Ledger gets into drifting.
But apparently there was no bad blood after they split, or supposedly, allegedly split. And in a 2016 interview with the Huffington Post, Julia Stiles recalled a note she'd recently rediscovered that Heath had written to her when they were together. I'm forgetting the beginning of the quote, she said, but it's something like, "Dance like you've never heard music and love like you've never been hurt. It was so sweet, I almost cried." That was his goodbye note to me. So that's all sweet, but here's where it gets weird. Director Gil Younger claims that Julia was actually in an on-set relationship with a different co-star, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I find this hard to believe, because as much as I'm all for the nerdy guy getting the girl, I cannot imagine that giving the choice between 1999-era Heath Ledger and Third Rock from the Sun-era Joseph Gordon-Levitt, the kid from Angels in the Outfield, she went with the latter.
JGL's cute, but he's no Heath Ledger. That's the thing.
You're a Batman head. I didn't really realize this, but I guess there was a lot of talk online about how much Heath Ledger and Joseph Gordon-Levitt resembled one another when they were in back-to-back Christopher Nolan Batman movies. I don't see it. I didn't see it then, and I don't see it now, but do you have thoughts on this?
No. Move on.
Okay. So yeah, that's weird. I don't know about this relationship between Julia Stiles and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. We'll touch more on that later, but all of this is mostly speculation. But it is true that Heath Ledger was Julia Stiles' first on-screen kiss, which is a good one. If you're going to have a first on-screen kiss, that's probably the one you want to go with. She would tell Cosmo in 2011 that he was the best kisser in Hollywood, which is cute. She had this to say after his tragic death in January 2009. "He was so nice. He was such a force. He was, even at that age, a very, very powerful, lovely human being." God, I remember when he died, where he was living was like, you can almost see it from my dorm. And a bunch of us like kind of wandered over there. What?
I had a guitar teacher once who I took like 3 lessons from this guy because he sucked so bad. He was a great guitarist, just a real piece of shit. And when Heath Ledger died, this guy had like a more than passing resemblance to Heath Ledger, like more than Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And he simply went to Keith Ledger's apartment and started busking out on the sidewalk. But it was just like so sociopathic of him to like just go to Heath Ledger's recently vacated by reason of death apartment and just stand outside the window and like, I don't know, play Hallelujah or some bullshit. Like,
was that the idea with you? Like, oh, was yeah. It was this an opera, like an opportunity, yeah. Or is he just like paying tribute? Okay.
No, let me see if I can find the interview where he talked about this incident.
Oh, he gave an interview about this. I thought he just was telling you about this.
No, I remember Googling him at one point, like researching him, and that's what came up. I mean, would you, honestly? If you looked like that and
if I looked like that, I wouldn't be playing a street corner. That's for damn sure.
That's true. All right. Where were we?
We have to talk about the other cast members.
Well, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Let's just say that little cutie boy, that little theater kid got around on set. Reportedly, he was dating Larissa Olenek, who played his on-screen crush, Bianca Stratford. Also, their characters in Third Rock from the Sun dated. Isn't that cute?
I like that. What do you think about that? I like that.
I just remember French Stewart from Third Rock from the Sun.
And
experiencing such a visceral dislike that I barely remember anything else about the show.
Yep.
Olenek is most famous for most people for her starring role in The Secret World of Alex Mack, or as Ken Cosgrove's wife on Mad Men, if you're a super weirdo. Funnily enough, her first kiss was Ryder Strong, a.k.a. Sean, when she was guesting on Boy Meets World. But they had actually met when they were 10 years old doing a production of Les Mis together. There's like 3 degrees of separation between all 90s teen stars.
It's true.
Anyway, Olenek reportedly wanted the role of Kat, the older sister, initially, and it eventually went to Stiles, who is only 3 months older than her, even though the character is portrayed as 2 years old.
I feel I'm legally obligated to mention in the Mamma Mia sequel when Cher was cast as Meryl Streep's mom, even though they're only like a year apart. Like, a good on Cher for being like, okay, yeah, I'll be Meryl Streep's mom.
And look better than everyone else in this movie.
Yes.
Funny side note, In the film, Kat is accepted to Sarah Lawrence College on the outskirts of New York. In real life, that is where Larissa Olenek went. Did you watch the sex crimes documentary? It's called Stolen Youth, about a bunch of Sarah Lawrence kids who got into like a horrifying, essentially like a sex human trafficking cult.
No.
Because one of their friends' dad moved into their dorm area. Like their, you can have these detached dorm style or housing dorms, like that are like detached houses. And her dad got out of jail and moved in there with them and slowly brought them all under his thrall.
I did hear about this. Oh, Liz Garbus produced this. She's amazing. Yeah. She did a great documentary on Bobby Fischer, the brilliant but troubled chess master, and also a really scary documentary called There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane, about a woman who drove the wrong way up some interstate parkway with her children in the car before crashing into a head-on, going like 85 miles an hour, and no one knows why or what happened.
The love-struck Cameron James, the nerd who desperately wants the hand of Bianca. That character name is, as you might assume, a semi-pointless joke about James Cameron. When Joseph Gordon-Levitt auditioned for the film, he initially wanted the role of Michael Ekman, later played by David Krumholz, the wise-ass friend who tries to help Cameron get the girl. So after having to be talked into auditioning, he then had to be talked into accepting one of the major parts. He told Vanity Fair in 2020, "I remember having a meeting with the directors where I was like, this doesn't make any sense, and this feels cheesy, and that feels cheesy. And they listened, I think, to some of my ideas. But mostly I think I was probably just wrong and kind of being too serious about the whole thing." Yeah, that's theater kid energy, pal. He admitted in the same interview, "The experience is actually what I love most about the whole thing. Even if people didn't like the movie, we had such a good time. All of us hung out all the time." Can you imagine Joseph Gordon-Levitt coming onto your set and giving you notes? I can, and it's infuriating.
Were you a theater kid? You sort of were.
So briefly, I missed my window, fortunately, thank God.
What were the shows?
Yes, Virginia.
Oh, wow.
In Our Town. I mean, I did play King Lear once.
Oh, wow. Oh, I would give
it. That was like the hardest thing I had to do in high school, except for like getting my black belt and Eagle Scout.
Oh, I'm
like,
sure.
Playing King Lear. I had to memorize all that shit. And then because we were just constantly being cut for time, they would literally be calling me up the night before and they were like, page 63 to 72 is cut. I was like, okay. And it is so fucking embarrassing to do Shakespeare. They made us do it in front of the whole school.
Oh, I could see you being incredible King Lear, though. No?
Don't ever want to do that again. I don't ever want to do that again in my life. It's so many words.
That's really cool. I say that's truly. That's really cool.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character learns French so that he can tutor Bianca. But in real life, the actor is fluent in the language. He shows off these skills later in the 2015 The Walk, in which he plays French tightrope talker Philippe Petit, who once walked between the Twin Towers.
Did you ever see that documentary?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's really, I mean, I'm scared of heights, so seeing it in the front row in the theater was a bad move. But yeah, it's really cool.
Man on Wire.
Incredible. Incredible movie. Yeah.
I don't know. I think the French should stick to miming. Another fun fact, at the beginning of the movie, Cameron James quotes a line from The Taming of the Shrew, end quote, "I pine, I burn, I perish." Okay, man. The role of the baddie teen who pays Heath Ledger's character to take out Kat, not like a mob hit, so her father would consent to him dating Bianca, was reportedly going to be played by James Franco, before ultimately going to Andrew Keegan. Franco had had a similar situation years later when he was supposed to play the love interest Aaron Samuels in Mean Girls, but was dismissed shortly into shooting. Technically, the Mean Girls producers never divulged who it was that they let go, but Daniel Francese, who played Damien, told the story in Altitude magazine in 2014, saying that the other actor hadn't shaved and didn't take his hat off. He was playing it really cool. People kept coming over to him like, "You know, you should really take your hat off." And then, right after the table read, he got fired.
Stinks of Franco.
Do you think Franco also came in with his hat off and not shaving? They talked about the one Freaks and Geeks person talked about how he's walking around with a copy of Camus in his back pocket. So like
he's fully that guy.
Yeah. And speaking of
great.
What was the segue? And speaking of greatness, we have to talk about teen movie royalty Gabrielle Union. who makes an appearance in this movie as a character, but is all in the rich lineage of her role and status as teen movie queen. She's in She's All That, Bring It On, and this film. Despite playing a teenager in all of these roles, Gabrielle Union was 25 while filming 10 Things I Hate About You. In the 2019 interview with the New York Times, she said, "I was over 10 years older than my younger cast members, some of whom were still in high school. I was kind of like, how close is this to my high school years? Do I look crazy playing a 15-year-old? Don't mention Earth, Wind, and Fire or give away your age."
She's 51 now. Well, moving through the supporting cast, we have found ourselves at David Krumholtz, who seems to be having a moment now due to his role in Oppenheimer. And also, apparently, just like putting it all out there on social media these days, at least he was.
He had a bunch of viral tweets on about how bad his experiences in Hollywood were. Like, just all the garbage you got to put up with and like embarrassing audition stories and stuff.
And then he deactivated his Twitter account recently. I guess the powers that be felt that he knew too much. And
they pulled the plug on him. You're like, you're getting a little too close to the truth, buddy. The handler deactivated him.
Well, his forthrightness has been clear in all interviews he's ever given about 10 Things I Hate About You. And he's become something of a cast diarist. As we'll get to in a moment, he wrote a very touching piece for Vulture a few years back, recalling his time on the set. Apparently that wasn't a miserable experience, but a very good one. This anecdote, however, is less touching. You'll recall that his character, Michael Ekman, the wise-ass geek that Joseph Gordon-Levitt wanted to play, winds up with genitalia drawn on his face, courtesy of the movie baddie Andrew Keegan. Krumholtz recently told HuffPo, "I remember having to teach Andrew Keegan how to draw a proper d*** on my face, which was a little strange to have to do. He was nervous. I was like, I draw tons of d***. Start with the head, do the shaft, get to the balls. Tremendous."
Imagine Daniel Day-Lewis giving an interview. Maybe it wasn't Hollywood's fault, buddy.
And now let's offset this vulgarity with a bit of the Bard. Krumholtz's character also quotes Shakespeare in this film, saying, "Sweet love, renew thy force," a line from Shakespeare's Sonnet 56. And now we are saving the best of the cast for last. Allison Janney. She plays the... What? Right?
No.
Am I right?
Yeah. No, it's just funny we get after all these teen stars and we're like, Allison Janney. Good for her, though.
I know. She plays the wonderful Miss Perky, the guidance counselor, who also writes erotic fiction on the side. She has that great exchange with Julia Stiles' character. "People perceive you as somewhat tempestuous. Heinous bitch is the term used most often." Oh, I love that. Allison Janney also ad-libbed the line where she gestures to the feline on her mug and goes cat and purrs, which people seem to like online. It's very GIF-able and Tumblr-friendly, I suppose.
GIF.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Despite...
I mean, that's a huge topic. I'm surprised it hasn't come up by now.
It has. I actually forget what I actually feel about GIF versus GIF, which says a lot more about me than it does about...
You just went with the one you knew would annoy me. You're like, I didn't... Somehow I feel like saying it.
Wait, now I forget. Hang on. I'm gonna say it how I would normally say it, and I actually forget what annoyed you. GIF.
GIF is correct.
Okay. All right.
It is an acronym for graphics interchangeable format.
Yes, I remember this now.
The word graphics does not start with a J sound.
Yes.
It's not graphics, folks. It's settled. It's like you don't use, I mean, it's like saying ATF or FBE, CER. Like, you don't just get to alter the way it's words, letters sound because it's part of an acronym.
It makes it a whole new word, though. All right. Okay. I see the color in your face turning different shades.
It's just a fact. That's not what the word sounds like. I feel like I'm taking crazy pills when people get into this conversation with me. It's like somebody, like, just walks up to you and, you know, they're like, Yeah, I mean, I spend a lot of time on my e-phone.
Well, okay, well, there's acronyms.
Twitter.com, Instagram.
There's acronyms.
Like having a stroke.
Like CIA, FBI, where you're saying letters. But then there's NASA, where words that are made up of full-on.
Yeah, but still all of those words that you're not changing the way that I'm, like, I'm sure somebody somewhere said NASA. And someone's like, no, it's not pronounced like that. But it's like, you don't say like radar or scuba. Mm. You don't say like scuba.
Because it's hard to say.
As with everything American, it comes down to convenience.
Where the hell are we? Speaking of America, okay. 10 Things I Hate About You came out just a few months before The West Wing premiered on NBC. And Allison Janney became known across the country as CJ Craig. But she always had fond memories of 10 Things I Hate About You because she said it was the first time in her, at that point, 10 plus year Hollywood career that she'd been paid a decent salary, which makes me sad.
Yeah. I never watched a single episode of The West Wing.
Nope, me neither.
Great.
Kind of seemed boring.
Yeah.
Well, now we're moving on to, we haven't even gotten to the production yet. 10 Things I Hate About You was shot in just 33 days in the summer of 1998, and it was shot almost entirely on location, actually, I believe entirely on location, in Tacoma, Washington. I've seen some listicles say that not a single set was built for this movie, which seems insane to me. They just used actual houses and schools and fields and what have you. In a sense, you could say the Pacific Northwest is a character in the film. And to celebrate the 20th anniversary in 2019, Seattle Magazine published a guide to all the 10 Things I Hate About You date spots. Such landmarks include Lake Union, where Kat and Patrick went paddle boating, the Fremont Troll, where Bianca and Cameron went to talk after school, and the Paramount Theater, where prom was held. Shout out to my friend Anna Maria, who was just visiting the Stratford family home in Tacoma, which is kind of what partially inspired me to do this episode.
And here's where Chris Cornell shot up heroin. And here's where Lane Staley shot up heroin.
But arguably the most precious locations for fans of 10 Things I Hate About You is the high school featuring the bleachers and the field, which we will talk about in a moment. The school is called Stadium High School, so named for the 15,000 seat stadium that we see during the infamous song scene. 15,000 seats for our public high school. That's insane. Wow. Yeah, I think it's a public school.
It is.
Wow. Between the epic coastal location and the truly overwhelming exterior, you'd be forgiven for assuming that this was some kind of rented mansion. That's because the building that houses the school was initially designed to be a French chateau-style luxury hotel financed by the North Pacific Railroad Company. However, due to the 1-2 punch of the financial crash of 1893 and a fire, work on the hotel was abandoned and the building sat empty for years before being repurposed and opened as a high school in 1906. And it's an historical landmark these days that's hosted speaking engagements from Presidents Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Warren G. Harding. The school still operates today and even held the 10 Things I Hate About You screening to mark the 20th anniversary of the film in 2019. In the movie, Stadium High School is renamed Padua High School. This is a reference to Padua, where Shakespeare set his play. And I guess now is a good time as any to mention that Patrick Verona's surname comes from the birthplace of his equivalent character in the Shakespeare play, and the Stratford sisters, Kat and Bianca, are named as a nod to Shakespeare's birthplace, Stratford-upon-Avon. The vibe on this set was unusually good, I'm pleased to report. The young cast all met in Tacoma and became fast friends by the end of the inaugural kickoff dinner held at the restaurant of the Sheridan where they were all staying. David Krumholtz wrote a very sweet remembrance of his experience on set for Vulture in 2015, and he referenced this welcome dinner specifically. He said, by the night's end, it was clear that this would be a transformative experience for all of us. I had only made a few films by that point, including The Santa Claus, which we are legally obligated to mention, and often found myself working with older actors, like Tim Allen, not ones of my generation. This was a chance to work with my peers. And as only Kismet would allow, I found myself getting along famously with my castmates. And he goes on to do a cute spotlight on each cast member in the piece. Work was fun, and after work, we were inseparable. We laughed, we partied, we rapped. Joseph Gordon-Levitt turned me on to fish, and I turned him on to Wu-Tang.
That was the worst sentence I think I've ever read. Those two in a room as teenagers talking about fish and the Wu-Tang Clan. Can you imagine Joseph Gordon-Levitt, like, the months after he discovered Wu-Tang Clan, is just, like, walking around talking about Shaolin and reciting the torture skit from 36 Chambers and just doing all the... He's probably talking like Method Man, like, ooh,
I'm gonna say,
don't ever give a theater kid access to rap.
I want to say, arguably...
That's how we got Lin-Manuel Miranda.
I was gonna say it might be worse after he was exposed to fish, though.
I mean, yeah, two roads diverge in a wood.
It's like mustard gas and pepper spray. Gabrielle Union had us in stitches. Julia Stiles brought her own brand of Soho bred artistic intellectualism, at only 17, mind you. Larissa Olenek's laughter filled the room, and we marveled at the tonedness of Andrew Keegan's muscles. A great sport. And Heath Ledger didn't arrive until a few days after the rest of the cast, since he was still due in Australia to continue his work on the TV show Roar. And Krumholz recalled worrying that the addition of this handsome new guy would disrupt the delicate social balance. But as he wrote, this was a concern that was remedied a few days later when he arrived, and we found yet another comrade in sensibility. The group with Heath only got stronger. Before I knew it, the cast was experiencing what I've since found to be all too rare, a unified chemistry throughout the ensemble, without a single bad apple in the bunch. We all agreed that we were having the best summer of our lives. Julia Stiles and pretty much everyone echoed the sentiment to Cosmo, saying that the most enjoyable part of filming was, quote, just being teenagers away from home, making a movie over the summer. It was ridiculous. It was such a special experience because it was so raw and we were so unfiltered, all of us in the cast. There was something innocent and pure about that time. The cast got along so well together that they even went to concerts and dinner. During a break from filming, they saw both the Beastie Boys and Pearl Jam. Heath's arrival really had a marked impact on both the cast and crew. Director Gil Junger's crush on Heath also continued to intensify. As he told HuffPo, working with Heath was so special. I'm not saying this because he's dead. One of the all-time qualifiers. I just liked being around him, you know, because he was alive. I added that last part. Guess he was all alive and all.
And so sexy. Just so taut.
He continued, most of the days, I find this a little weird. Most of the days, I would have my driver pick me up a little early, and then I'd go pick up Heath so I could take the extra half hour ride in with him because I just found him to be so freaking interesting. He was amazing.
I just like, man, if you are, that borders on like stalking. If you're like picking up your male star a half an hour early for call without telling him and then just driving around with him in the car. That is,
limo's a white van.
Yeah, that is alarming. What did he have, like Bartles and James in the back or something? Like, hey, get in there. Like Luther Vandross is on the stereo. Young's already got his shirt off. Ugh.
Yeah.
Man. Well, where were we?
Gabrielle Union recalled Heath's impressive arrival during a 2016 episode of Watch What Happens Live with Andy Cohen. Heath told me and anyone else who was over 21 to go meet him at the top of the bar at the top of this hotel. And we walk in and he's just got this wild hair. And again, he's 19 and he's got like a dad drink. And he gets up and he was just such a man, such a gentleman. But wait, he was 19. Maybe the hotel was in Canada? I don't know. It's almost close to Canada, right? No.
Other fans of all the underage strange in the movie may remember. Fans of the movie will recall the scene in which Julia Stiles gets drunk at a house party. For reasons. And in a rare instance of letting loose around her classmates, starts dancing on a tabletop. And then she whacks her head on the chandelier. It may surprise no one to learn that those dance moves were improvised by Julia Stiles, and it got her the role of Save the Last Dance woman. I mean, that sets the, that sort of is the tenor of her dance presence in that movie. It was like drunk white girl who thinks she's down. Maybe gets a little too comfortable in certain settings, saying certain things. The Save the Last Dance guy saw her drunkenly dancing on a table and was like, there's the lead of my new film about solving interracial strife in Chicago. In Chicago's South Side. Dumbass. Anyway. Folks, it's been long enough. Now we have to talk about the most iconic scene in the movie.
It is.
One that the fine folks at Huffington Post dedicated an entire long read to. Great read. Check it out.
It is.
And it's the moment when Heath Ledger tries to make amends with Julia Stiles' character for not kissing her when she was blackout drunk, if memory serves. And he crashes her success practice?
Soccer practice. What does success practice look like for you, Heigl?
Crying. crashing her soccer practice with a marching band and serenading her with a delightfully cringy version of Frankie Valli's Can't Take My Eyes Off of You. Though it's hard to believe now, that was not the original song that they wanted to use. According to multiple sources, they were going back and forth between I Think I Love You by the Partridge Family or I Touch Myself by the Divinyls, which I'm guessing was a Junger pick. Gil Junger's like, what if we have him? Bear with me, guys. What if we have this f-ing sexy guy who we found singing about masturbating?
In front of a bunch of could underage women.
Yeah, could have legs. What do you guys think?
Just let it marinate. No. Let it marinate. We'll talk about it.
Yeah, we'll come back to it tomorrow. We'll circle back. We'll circle back. Good Lord.
I know.
Screenwriter Karen McCullough told the New York Times, I think Heath decided that that wasn't romantic enough, so he chose the Frankie Valli song, which was a much better call. Some have also stated that that was Julia Stiles' idea, but I don't think she's interesting enough for that. He was apparently very... I'm sorry. I can't...
It's okay.
It's like tonguing a sore tooth now. I just can't stop doing it. Heath was apparently very nervous before shooting the scene because he'd never sung in front of anyone, which is so, so cute. Heath took an active interest in preparing for the scene. He reportedly worked hard on his wardrobe. Screenwriter Kirsten Smith told Vice in 2017, he was so specific about what he wanted to wear. It had to be this certain type of dark shirt with a precise fit. Oddly, it's kind of a nondescript ensemble when you actually watch the movie, but seeing him architect the costume as part of his preparation was so impressive, especially because he was only 19. He also trained with choreographer Marguerite Pomhern Derricks, which is, as a Christopher Guest mockumentary name if I've ever heard one, who was blowing up at the time because she choreographed the Austin Powers street dancing intro. Derricks prepared Heath by showing him scenes from the newly released Showgirls. Showgirls, iconic movie, and lots of Fred Astaire movies. Then at the 11th hour, they decided to have Heath backed by a full-scale marching band. I'm shocked they didn't fly out the USC Trojans for it.
Whoa.
The school where they were filming, Stadium High School, didn't have a marching band, so director Gil Junger sent an assistant to nearby Lincoln High School to enlist one.
Hey, go to all the high schools nearby.
Find all the really... You know, the ones that ooze sexuality. You know what? I better go with you on this one. I'm just going to... Everybody, we'll wrap. We'll wrap. We'll do a nooner. I'm going to go with... my casting director. It's going to be a very busy afternoon.
Hold this trombone.
Yeah, really slide it. The band director said no. Perhaps realizing the kids revolted, the student leader of the marching band ended up getting a glorified extra role in the film. And since Heath's character was such an outcast, they decided to film a scene of him paying the band leader $300 afterward.
Where do you think that idea came from?
I'm going to show you how to palm this $100 bill. Not something I've done a lot in my life down on Skid Row, but... Just to really, Gil Junger. This became a bit of a running gag. You'll remember this band leader becomes the guy who could get things done. Right. You remember the cops who chased Heath Ledger across the bleachers, prompting a slightly premature end to the song. I guess it's illegal to karaoke in public.
Yeah, on what grounds? He goes to the school. He's not trespassing.
It's the woke left, you know. An actor playing one of the cops, the overweight one that Heath gooses, actually had the paramedics called after shooting the scene because he was having shortness of breath and thought he was having a heart attack. Okay, man.
I don't have an update as to whether or not he lived. I assume he did.
Moving on. For the scene in which Julia Stiles reads the titular poem in class, that was done in one take, and the tears she cried were not planned. She later told Cosmo, "When it came to filming, I never expected that I was going to start crying. I don't know why I did, whether it connected to something going on at the time, or if I was just overwhelmed by the whole experience of making my first big movie. I thought that was going to be much more touching," and she simply said she did just cried for no reason.
Well, you'll see. There's more.
Furthermore, director Gil Junger told the New York Times that her performance made him cry, too. "I did everything I could to cover my mouth and nose because I was crying so hard. It was such an amazing performance. The take in the film is the first take. I think I jumped up and just hugged her for the longest time." Gil Junger always makes mouth sounds when he's on a hot mic.
Oh.
Despite the rumored affair between Heath and Julie, Gil Junger says that Julie was actually in love with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and it was her affection for him that drew this impassioned performance out of her. He has said this in numerous interviews over the years, including one to the Spanish outlet Mira Quien Encontre. I asked her, "Where did that come from?" And she told me, "I was just thinking about the person's name that she was deeply in love with at the time. It wasn't me, certainly, but it wasn't Heath either. She, for a minute or 10, went out with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. They were very, very attracted to each other. I should know. I was watching. She's professing her love to Ledger, and she's in love with the guy waiting in his trailer to shoot the next scene. Watching them, it was beautiful how much they enjoyed each other. God, this guy is f***ing weird.
I should know. I was watching." For legal reasons, we should say that we have no evidence to claim that Gil Junger
is a pederast.
Or acted inappropriately on the set of this film.
Yeah, we're just reading in between a lot of lines. As you meditate on that, we'll be right back with more Too Much Information after these messages.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta. visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Great soundtrack, right?
Yeah.
Time capsule of a soundtrack. Cardigans, Semisonic, Sister Hazel, Save Ferris performs at the John Hughes style prom alongside Letters to Cleo.
A friend of mine's uncle was briefly in that band. It's a Boston area band.
Letters to Cleo performed the second best known song in this movie, a cover of Nick Lowe's Cruel to Be Kind, the title of which is a line from Shakespeare. They are also the band who cover Cheap Trick's I Want You to Want Me on the roof of the school at the end of the movie, which you naturally took to be an homage to the Beatles.
It's probably not.
Start doing Rorschach tests with you and just saying, does this remind you of the Beatles, John? Or Jordan? Does this remind you of the Beatles? Looks like my parents divorced. It's an actual picture. It's an actual picture of John and Paul. Apparently, director Gil Junger asked Disney if they could do this very costly scene, and the company said no. So instead, this first-time director decided to lie to the producer and say that Disney said it was okay.
And they didn't even get a permit to get the shot either.
He went rogue, getting a bunch of high schoolers and getting a bunch of sexy teens and a few bands up on a rooftop on an extremely windy day. And naturally...
It's just one band. To be fair, it was just one band.
Oh, so sorry. It was just Letters to Cleo and a bunch of sexy teens. Letters to Cleo lead singer Kay Hanley evocatively described the scene to the New York Times in 2019. We're all arranged on top of this postage stamp-sized roof with chicken wire, the only thing protecting us from toppling to our deaths into the Puget Sound. The overhead shots were achieved by a helicopter, and they were told that each flyover cost $500,000, so it was very important that they didn't f*** it up. Unfortunately, director Gil Junger didn't tell them that he was going to order the pilot to practically fly into them. Singer Kay Hanley continued, as we started playing, we saw the helicopter appear off in the distance. It's hard to say how far it was at first because we were up so high in the air. But then all of a sudden, the helicopter does this dive bomb directly toward us. Is the helicopter out of control? Is it supposed to be coming at us like this? And I'm thinking, don't f*** up. Keep singing the song. It costs $500,000 every time the copter takes off. It was unbelievably scary. But it turned out to be such an amazing shot. According to one interview, Kay said that she literally peed her pants.
I don't know if literally has lost its meaning.
Can we confirm that? Can we run that down through the fact check department? The research, the iHeart research department?
Well, while I run that down, did you know that Gil Junger actually wanted this to be the soundtrack to the movie that they were going to play up on the roof?
Do you know what it's time for?
Oh, no.
A sexy party!
It's wow, watching that. Yeah, that's so obscene. I wasn't even gonna watch it because I know it, but watching it and as if pretending that that's the director of 10 Things I Hate About You made it so much funnier.
Kel Junger, man. Maybe that's why he was so comfortable being pervy, because he knew that there was a chance he might kill them. He wanted to go out on top. If I'm going to John Landis this bitch, I'm going to make sure that I've got my jollies with these sexy teens first.
I mean, you know, in a way, it's surprising that his career didn't do better, because when 10 Things I Hate About You was released on March 31st, 1999, it was a huge critical and commercial success. It grossed something like $60 million against a $13 million budget. And it served as a springboard for many of its stars, including Julia Stiles, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and of course, Heath Ledger. Here he is again. I forgot I had him here. Director Gil Junger warned Heath about the attention that he would receive following the release of the film. As he recalled to HuffPo, I told Heath, Look, I just want you to know that when this movie comes out, you're not going to know what hit you. People are going to be clamoring to work with you. And I bet your next offer is going to be $1 million. And as a new friend, I was just telling him to do his best to remain who he was. An old soul, mature, not distracted by drugs. Then he said to me, I really appreciate the advice, but rather than worry about what's going to happen, help me be the best I can today. For an 18-year-old who's getting his first movie, I thought he was 19, and that first movie is with a Disney studio, and that director of your first movie telling you you're going to be a huge star, any kid would have been like, oh man, that's so cool. I hope so. But not Heath. He just wanted to be the best he could in that moment. That's so telling of who he was. Or you're his director and not his life coach, and he just wanted to
I had my shirt off at the time. You know, Keith, if you ever just want to come over and run lines, I can pick you up in the van. Or if you ever want to, like, you ever just want to read some Byron together.
Heath reportedly turned down offers of similar teen movies after his turn in 10 Things I Hate About You because he was fearful of getting typecast. Obligatory memoriam for Heath. He starred in 16 films prior to his death due to accidental drug intoxication on January 22nd, 2008. At the age of 28. During his too brief career, he earned 2 Oscar nominations, posthumously winning for Best Supporting Actor in 2009 for The Dark Knight. While researching this movie's legacy, I was surprised to stumble on a short-lived TV adaptation that aired on ABC Family for a single season in 2009. Gil Junger directed the pilot, and I think a few other episodes too. But Larry Miller, who played Cat and Bianca's father, was the only cast member to reprise his role from the feature film. But the TV adaptation's co-starred Nicholas Braun, a.k.a. Cousin Greg from Succession, as the Joseph Gordon-Levitt character Cameron James. And I also learned, thanks to friend of the pod Max Biddle, I hope I'm saying your name right, that Nicholas Braun's dad, Craig Braun, designed the Lips logo for the Rolling Stones, as well as the cover for Sticky Fingers, the Who's Tommy soundtrack, Alice Cooper's School's Out, the Carpenters logo. Look up Craig Braun's Wikipedia page. It's really nuts how many iconic rock designs he is responsible for. So that's weird. I'm glad we got to the Rolling Stones from 10 Things I Hate About You in an authentic way in this episode. Have you seen Cousin Greg?
No.
He's tall. He's a tall boy.
Well, that goes a long way.
Apparently, he gets smoked salmon from the same place I do in Williamsburg.
Well, I mean, the thing is that I'm not looking at him through my eyes. I'm looking at him through Gil Junger's eyes. Oh, but he's 6'7".
Was Heath Ledger tall?
I don't know. I think he was probably actually short.
Yeah, I can see that. He's got that, like, kind of Brit rock star Jimmy Page, George Harrison.
I thought you'd be taller.
Yeah. But yes, Gil Junger directed the pilot, but a guy called Carter Covington is the one who created the 10 Things I Hate About You show. Weirdly, or maybe not, because they knew it was going to be bad, the original screenwriters Kristen Smith and Kara McCullough were not involved with the show. Covington decided to move the focus of the series away from the romantic relationships and instead onto the relationship between the two sisters. A somewhat evolved take for a ABC Family show, but a poor one. I love the movie, and I think a lot of people love the movie, Covington told the Futon critic. I know there can be a lot of backlash when you try to turn a hit movie into a television show, but I'd always wanted to do a show about siblings. I think the sibling dynamic is incredibly ripe for comedy. Audiences disagreed. In a world overrun with half-baked sequels and remakes, it seems shocking that there hasn't been a 15 Things I Hate About You or 8 Things I Hate About You or some other equally questionable take. But don't worry, they tried. Director Gil Junger wrote a sequel called 10 Things I Hate About Life, and he reportedly tried to send the script to Heath Ledger. As he told Huffington Post, 2 weeks before Heath died, I was just finishing a script for him that I wanted him to star in, 10 Things I Hate About Life. I called Steve Alexander, Heath's agent, and asked if Heath could give me a call so I could share this exciting project with him. He said Heath would be taking no work calls at all while he's filming Dark Knight because he's so far into the character that he can't get out of it and he's having incredible trouble sleeping. That role shook him. He took it so seriously and so professionally and so profoundly that he couldn't escape it.
And I should know about people not being able to escape.
What if Heath Ledger's alive and he just faked his own death to try to get away from this
guy? Get away from Gil. You know,
and not make this movie. Following Heath's death, Junger kept tinkering with his script, which was more of an unofficial sequel. He described it to Variety in 2012 as, quote, the story of two relatable, ordinary people with normal jobs and normal desires whose seemingly great lives have become unmanageable. Two people who go to the same place at the same time to end it. Their chance meeting is so awkward, so raw, and so funny, they postpone their intentions, presumably ending it, and go their separate ways. Which is very similar to a Nick Hornby book called A Long Way Down about a bunch of people, if I'm remembering correctly, who meet on New Year's Eve at the top of a building and they all plan to jump off, I think. And the same thing happens. They decide how hilarious it is and how ridiculous their circumstances. They all decide to live. And then I think the story is told every year on New Year's, they meet up. It's almost like a little support group or something. I don't know. I haven't read it in a while. It was a good book. Anyway.
I don't care. Yeah.
Evan Rachel Wood was eventually tapped to be the female lead in 10 Things I Hate About Life. And filming began in late 2012, but was interrupted after 2 months due to management changes at the production company and also Evan Rachel Wood's pregnancy. In late 2013, when production was set to resume, Wood left the project, claiming that the producers were unable to pay her a salary. The producers then sued her for $30 million for breach of contract. Her lawyers responded that Wood was never adequately paid for the work she'd already done since the production company had run out of money. There have been some production stills and about 30 minutes of footage from this project that have surfaced, but as of 2021, the lawsuit is ongoing, and it's been stated by the producers and Gil Junger that the film will never be completed, thus sparing us a sequel nobody asked for this great, beloved 90s teen classic. What else is there to say about 10 Things I Hate About You? It's a quality movie that didn't talk down to its young audience, respected the intense emotions from that age, and more or less told you not to change yourself for anyone. And I think that's cool. In that regard, it's the anti-Grease. If Sandy at the end of Grease completely changes herself to win over her desire of her affections, this one's the total opposite, by being accepted for who you are. And I think that's wonderful. It's a well-made movie, with a great message, great performances, without taking itself too seriously. I feel like both of these display the duality of this great movie. The first of these messages was a sweet, candid photo of Heath with a caption reading, "This Sunday marks the 20th anniversary of the release of 10 Things I Hate About You, and all I can think about is this kind soul, this leader, this talent, my friend. Just too good to be true." And then he followed up this message with a photo of himself from the film with a penis crudely drawn on his face. There you have the yin and yang of 10 Things I Hate About You.
Was it Junger's? He comes over shirtless like, "Hey boys, what you working on?"
David, you are quite the artist.
Yeah. Do you need any figure? Do you do any figure studies? Have you ever? Do you want to? Why don't you and Keith come to my trailer after this? Heath. He could sue us over this. Make sure you cut enough of these that we're not libelous. Yeah, thank you for listening, folks. Everybody, you know, stay young at heart. I'm Alex Heigl.
And I'm Jordan Runtog. We'll catch you next time. If Gil Junger hasn't sued us into oblivion yet.
Too Much Information was a production of iHeartRadio.
The show's executive producers are Noel Brown and Jordan Runtog.
The show's supervising producer is Michael Alder June.
The show was researched, written, and hosted by Jordan Runtog and Alex Heigl,
with original music by Seth Applebaum and the Ghost Funk Orchestra. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts on iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Oh, hi.
Hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.